Well, it's time for us to begin. Thank you for being here and welcome to our visitors. We're happy to see you again. Glad that you're here with us to study. We're in John chapter 11, studying concerning the raising of Lazarus from the dead. This is in a series of studies concerning the life of Christ. We've been doing this series for quite a little while, but there is a lot of information on this in the four Gospels, of course. But in the book of John, we're noticing this last of the miracles that Jesus performed. Only seven, I believe, recorded by John. And he tells us in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, why he selects these particular ones. So that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. With that backdrop, we're going to be studying about the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Several things from John chapter 11. Well, the setting for our study tonight begins actually in the 10th chapter, as we noted that Jesus went away again beyond the Jordan, unto the place where John was at the first baptizing, and he abode there. And many signs, or many came to him, it says. And they said, John indeed did no sign, but all things whatsoever John spake of this man were true, and many believed on him there. And that's crucial to set the stage on the map of the things that we want to talk about. We don't find the word Perea in our New Testament. However, it is the place that is identified on our map, just on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, Jordan River. And one of the things that we want to note is that the word Perea comes to us from a Greek word that simply means beyond, and that term is used in this passage to tell us that this is where John baptized, that he was baptizing beyond the Jordan, and that's what the term means. So it helps us, I think, in all of our studies to get a geographic location in our minds as to where we're talking about on the map and some other events, of course, that took place relative to that. And as we note, this is the area just north of here where John had baptized. Later he moved a little further north of that. But the point is, this is familiar territory to the preaching of John and those who were disciples of John and now to Jesus and to the disciples of Jesus. In this chapter, we read of him raising Lazarus from the dead. We've mentioned John 20, 30, and 31, the purpose of these particular miracles that John records, so that you might believe in who Jesus is and have life. In our study last week, we discussed quite extensively the earlier, the midsection of this chapter, and we noted that in that context that Jesus is telling Martha and eventually then to Mary what he is preparing to do. They didn't understand it. They thought he was talking about the general resurrection from the dead, but he's telling them that Lazarus is going to be made alive. And of course, the question is, how's that possible, seeing Lazarus has been dead for 4 days and his body's begun the decay process and begins to stink? Now, we noted in the study last week this statement that's made actually three times. One by Martha in verse 21, when she said, Lord, if thou hast been here, my brother had not died. And then when Mary comes on the scene in verse 32, she said essentially the same thing. If thou hast been here, my brother had not died. And of course, being as Lazarus is dead and folks are coming to comfort Martha and Mary, there gathers somewhat of a crowd of folks. And it tells us in verse 37 that some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of him that was blind have caused that this man also should not die? Now, several interesting things we were talking about concerning that, and even regarding the development of our faith, and I think the development of Martha and Mary's faith. You'll notice that the statement is made early on when Jesus asked Martha regarding the resurrection. He said, believest thou this, in verse 26, and she saith unto him, yea, Lord, I have believed that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, even he that cometh into the world. And we talked quite a little bit about that in our last study, and I think the conclusion and consensus generally is that Martha and Mary had known of Jesus' work, were close friends along with their brother Lazarus for a period of time. And now Jesus has been preaching close to 3.5 years. He's just on the front end of the last week of his life, the last week of his life beginning in chapter 12. So we're about 2 weeks or so out from his crucifixion. And the preaching, the miracles, and all of that is for the most part, been done. It's on the timeline previous to this. And our point is that Martha and Mary and even Lazarus, while he was yet alive, had knowledge of these things and likely had witnessed many of these things. And so this crowd as well that has gathered, because they reference what took place in John chapter 9 with the restoring of sight to the blind man. But I think the thing, at least in my mind, that becomes a little bit ironic is the proposition that Jesus is going to raise Lazarus from the dead. Now that too was not strange in the history of Jesus. He had done that, and Luke records for us how that he'd raised the widow of Nain's son from the dead. Now the difference being, on this occasion, their point of being perplexed, I guess, would be Lazarus had been dead 4 days. I think, Randy, you mentioned last time that the widow of Nain's son, he had evidently just died. And according to the practice of the Jews, it was something that was done immediately to take them out and bury them and before this process started. But now he's been entombed and the process has started. He's decayed and the body is smelling. And the question then, you want to take away the stone from the tomb. His body it stinks. And so that, I think, presents a little bit of curiosity, at least in my mind, when we think about the place that Martha and Mary are. If you read the bulletin article, and I'm confident that most all of you did, but in the bulletin article, one of the points that I've tried to make is that learning is a process. And sometimes, even though you've examined the facts and maybe you've come to a conclusion, there may be some other things, especially on such an occasion as this, that might move you just a little bit on the conclusion that you have drawn. You might think about some things a little bit beyond what you had thought about them before. And maybe that's the case here. I don't know. I don't presume to try to identify at what point we are in the faith of Martha and Mary. They believe that Jesus is the Christ, and she's expressed confidence that whatever Jesus says to the Father, he'll respond. But the idea of raising Lazarus from the dead when his body has begun the decaying process, I'm not so sure and certainly not convinced in my mind that they see that as probable by these statements that are made. But again, be that as it may, when Jesus said to Martha, "Thy brother shall rise again," and she said, "I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day," she's very clear on that. She's clear on what's going to take place in the last days and we talked about that in our last study. And then this question, do you believe this? Now, there doesn't seem to be any reservation in her expression that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Son of God, that he is the one that, and this kind of was the jump start of some of our discussion, that had been discussed in the Old Testament that was yet to come. Now, not only could Jesus raise Lazarus from physical death, which Martha and Mary, I think, are convinced of, but at this point, can he raise Lazarus from the dead in the way that he's planning to do just here, miraculously, not at the last day, not the general resurrection, but on this occasion, which he is expressing that he's about to do. So that's the question, I think, that becomes a springboard into some other things in this chapter. She says, "I know who you are." But the kind of confidence that I'm convinced he's asking her, I'm not so sure that she's sure of. Randy?
I think it's interesting in this text. Verse 23, Jesus said, "Your brother will rise again." It's very personal. Your brother specifically.
Yeah.
"Your brother will rise again." She says, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And then Jesus goes away from the specific talking about your brother to everyone and says, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me," that means anyone.
Yes.
That means the billions of people who have lived on the earth.
Jews and Gentiles alike.
That means everyone on the face of God's green earth.
Yeah.
Not just your brother, but everyone who believes in me, who lives and who dies, and everyone who lives, everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Then, do you believe this? So it's like, you know, I know you believe that your brother's going to rise again on the last day, but do you believe that I have the power to raise everyone?
Yeah, that's a real biggie, isn't it? That takes it to a whole nother level. Yeah. That's a good observation. Excellent. Appreciate that. Sure appreciate that. And the point I think that you're establishing is more than just something academic. For everyone to be raised, it's more than just academic, believing in who Jesus is. It has somewhat to do with your actions, your practice, and that ties us with James chapter 2 and Hebrews chapter 5 and so forth. The passages that we have on the board, Romans 6. Excellent. All right, again, as we note in these verses, she saith, yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God. Notice, if you will, that dropping down in that text, Mary expresses the same confidence in the Lord that Martha has expressed. Neither of these sisters are being critical of Jesus. They're just simply observing, we know what you have done in the past. And the reference is to John chapter 9 with the restoring of sight to the man that was born blind. He has the power to do that. Now, that we talked about last week. I want to go just a little bit further in this. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus has power over death. He has power to give life, which indicates that he has power over Satan. A passage that for a long time, frankly, I think that I had either misunderstood or overlooked is found in Hebrews chapter 2. And I want to call your attention to it because I think it gives meaning not only to our text, but some Old Testament texts that we want to look at. In Hebrews chapter 2, beginning in verse 14, the text tells us, since then the children are sharers in flesh and blood, he also himself in like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, and might deliver all them who through the fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. What an impressive passage. Jesus overcame death, which indicates he overcame the devil, because the devil is the one that imposed death, if you please, through sin. But Jesus overcame death. Now, question. When we take that thought back to the familiar text of Isaiah chapter 53, let's turn back there. Isaiah chapter 53. In Isaiah chapter 53, we know, of course, that Isaiah is referred to, and we frequently refer to that prophet as the Messianic prophet. Many details are given in Isaiah chapter 53, identifying who Jesus is and what he did. In verse 5, for example, we learn that he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. We're familiar with this passage. We're familiar with the specifics of verse 7. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth, as a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep that is that before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Verse 9, again, specifically, and they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. These are all very specific things that we identify with Jesus and his death. But if you drop down into that text, to the latter part of verse 11 and verse 12, specifically verse 12. The latter part of verse 11 says, and he shall bear their iniquity. So we know who he's talking about. He's talking about the Messiah, the Son of God. But look at verse 12. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. The thought that I'm looking at specifically is that he shall divide the spoil with the strong. What was the practice of kings of Isaiah's day, or even into the days of the Romans? What was the practice of kings when they conquer another king?
They usually got the spoils.
They got the spoils. That's right. They would put them into the king's treasurer or treasury. But when Jesus had the spoils, what did he do with it?
Divided it.
He divided it among folks. And now take that thought with me back to Hebrews chapter 2, where we were just a moment ago, when he overcame death. He became flesh and blood. He shared in it, verse 14 tells us. He partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught or bring to nothing him that had power over death. Now, would it be a given then to say that now Jesus has gained victory over death? And what does he do with the spoils of his victory? He shares them. Do you see a connection between what we're talking about here and where we've been in our studies in the book of Revelation, and in particular toward the end of that great book, but even the beginning in chapter 1, is it 17 or is it verse 18, where Jesus is identifying himself and he said, I have overcome death, the point being I hold the keys of death and Hades.
So the spoil then is everlasting life.
I believe that's right. He provides that. Now take all of that. He holds the keys of death. He's the victor. He shares the spoils. Take all of that with you back to the text of John chapter 11 when we talk about what he has the power to do. He had the power over Satan. Come forth from death, and according to Hebrews 2, to destroy Satan's power. He holds the keys of death and Hades. That would indicate that he then, of course, as he establishes a number of times, not just in John chapter 14, but even as early as John chapter 6, he is the giver of life. And isn't that the message that he's trying to present to Martha in this text? He's the giver of life. Now, not just physical life, but he's the giver of spiritual life. And that's the point that it seems Martha's having a hard time wrapping her mind around, that he can do that. But what must happen first? Before he can give spiritual life, what has to happen first?
He has to die.
He has to die. That's right. And that's what Hebrews 2 is teaching us. So that he can share the spoils with you and me, others who have committed sin, as all of us have. Now, question. Believest thou this? That's a pretty big one, isn't it, Randy, as you pointed out. He has the ability to raise everybody from the dead. But he has the ability to provide spiritual life to everybody that will believe on him. Now, do you believe that, Martha? That's why I think that I find it just interesting. If I were to ask you that, you would immediately say yes with an exclamation mark. And you don't see that here. And I can't help but, maybe it's just the way my mind works, wonder why she didn't just say yes, exclamation mark, end of story. But these questions continue. Mary raises the question, essentially, if thou makest the statement, if thou had been here, then my brother wouldn't have died. And now here's the multitude in verse 36. If you can make this blind man over here in John 9 to be able to see, then if you were here, Lazarus wouldn't have died. But now I am here. But it's 4 days later. If you think that I can make a blind man see, why do you have an issue with me making this man alive again? I have the power of life, even spiritual life. I can raise everybody on the planet that's ever lived from the dead. And so here is the issue. Do you believe this? So it's more than just simply for our benefit, more than just saying, well, yes, I've examined the evidence and I agree that the evidence supports this. Well, does it enough to cause you to conform your life to his? Isn't that the question? It's more than just accepting certain things as true. And we talked about this statement last time, and I'm thankful to Jenny, and I did a little more research on that, that when Jesus saw Mary weeping and the Jews also weeping, it tells us he groaned in the spirit and was troubled and said, where have you laid him? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. Well, certainly we note that the recognition of the Jews, look at how he loved him. We see a mark of compassion, humanity, on behalf of Jesus expressed in this passage. Now, another thing that I wanted to note with you, and I'm going to pass over that chart. I want to deal with this one. Some of the disciples, as we mentioned, ridiculed him that, well, if he'd been here, then Lazarus would not have died. Dan King, in his comments on this, makes another rather interesting statement. He says, her confession is that Jesus is the Messiah, promised before by the old prophets, the very Son of God. This was what had been declared by John the Baptist. We talked about that in John 1, verse 34. And accepted by the disciples. Again, we saw that in John 1, verse 49, and again in John 6. It ought then to raise our suspicion when she later protests to the Lord's command to take away the stone, in verse 39, showing that her faith is still less than what it ought to have been. Now, let that hit bottom. Take away the stone. Why would she object? If she believed that Jesus had not only the power over physical death, but the power over spiritual death. Take away the stone. She said, Lord, he's been in there for 4 days. We can't do that. He stinks. But they did. And what we want to note then is that Jesus groaned. I mentioned last time, and I want to revisit this, and if you'll indulge me a little bit. I don't want to make more out of that than what's there. But words help us a little bit. Definition of words. Here you see on the screen the word from which groaned is translated. And it indicates to have indignation, to blame, to sigh or chagrin, to sternly enjoin. In John chapter 11, Thayer tells us that in a sense unknown to secular authors, to charge with earnest admonition, sternly to charge, threateningly to enjoin. Now, I've tried to make a distinction. I don't know if you can see it on the screen, a little different color down here, because W.E. Vines gives a little bit different definition of this word that I think is somewhat enlightening. He specifically indicates that groaned in John 11:33, preferable to the revised margin, he had indignation, and this is what we talked about last week. The Lord was deeply moved, doubtless with a combination of circumstances, present and in the immediate future. Indignation does not here seem to express his feelings. I thought, well, that's interesting, because here we've got lexicographers that give a general definition of the word, how it's used in a whole lot of passages. And even the footnote in the American Standard Translation implies that he was moved with indignation. And perhaps in the reading or studying of the text, we can see some frustration of the miracles that Jesus has performed. And now here he is a week out from being crucified. And even those that are the closest to him still express at least a marginal bit of doubt of his ability. Would that not cause you some frustration? W.E. Vine says, though that's the general meaning of the word, he's not convinced that that's the meaning here. That in this instance, it just simply means that Jesus was stirred with emotion because of the death of Lazarus. And Randy, probably you've got the nail hit on the head when we look at the overall of both of these elements. Yes, Jesus had lost somebody that was close to him. Would that disturb you? Yes. If you had performed these miracles for 3.5 years and the people that you're the very closest to express even a shred of doubt about what you can do, would that be frustrating to you as well? So the use of this word groaned in this text, I think, has a dual application, if you please. Now, maybe I'm trying to ride the fence on that. I don't know. But I think it's interesting to note that this is the word that the Holy Spirit used in this connection with this particular episode. And indeed, we've seen in John chapter 6 the frustration of Jesus. John chapter 5, the frustration of Jesus. And even the frustration of Jesus when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying and left Peter, James, and John to pray for him and came back and found them asleep. So yes, here's the human element. And the human element involves not only being moved because of the loss of a loved one, but the frustration of the evidence that's been presented and still questioned. Now, that's about all I got to say on that. Any comments or questions following that? Does that make any kind of sense to us?
Yeah. What I was going to say was it's not just the loss of a loved one, but the compassion of those who were weeping.
Oh, yes.
He's surrounded by people that are evil.
Yeah.
Surrounded by people that are, you know, friends and family and people that are, everyone's crying.
Well, sure.
That's what happens at a funeral.
Sure, yeah. And so you've got the human element involved in this. So it's not just frustration, but compassion. Yes, I think you've got both elements in this equation, in this passage that we need to be aware of. Now, 4 days had passed since Lazarus had died. His body, as we've mentioned, had begun to deteriorate. There was no question, and I think, Juan, you pointed this out last time, no question this man is dead, and he's beyond what would seem to be normal means of even performing a miracle, put everything back together again. I mean, his body started to decompose. And so the point being is, Jesus had told them that the reason why he had tarried was so that they might behold the glory of God. And we saw that back up in verse 4. Now, that is parallel with the restoring eyesight to the blind man in John 9. The question was raised, why was the man born blind? Well, Jesus said not because his parents sinned or because he sinned, but in order that God might be glorified in what's about to take place. And he restored his sight to him. And that's what we see here. If Lazarus was raised from the dead, God would be glorified. Now notice, if you will, that trusting faith of the sisters, Martha and Mary, stands in contrast to the unbelieving chief priest who saw this miracle in John chapter 12. And as you'll note later in this same chapter, in verse 47 and 48, after Lazarus was raised from the dead, we don't want other folks knowing about this. Because if other folks find out about what Jesus has done, they'll believe in him too. And we can't be having that. So what was their answer to it in John 12? Kill Lazarus. Yes. Kill Lazarus. Now you'll note that in John chapter 12, we're beginning the last week of Jesus' life. So it's not just kill Lazarus, but they're plotting to kill Jesus as they have been, but now in earnest. So that, I think, sets us a rather interesting contrast when we look at Martha and Mary and then these unbelieving Jews. Well, that brings us down then to verse 41. It says, so they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou heardest me. And I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the multitude that standeth around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. Now let's look at that. First of all, what we note is that Jesus is thanking God that God hears him. This is not a request of God that God would raise Lazarus from the dead. He is thankful, rather, that God hears him. And expressing himself here for the benefit of these that are present, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin, and Jesus said unto them, loose him and let him go. I want to note just a little bit of some things that I read about the custom of the Jews in the burial procedure. Now we see that to be true when Jesus' body was prepared for burial. Later on we'll have occasion to talk more about that. But the text tells us that he was bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. When you read this, I would probably be right, I'm going to guess, if the picture that comes to your mind is something kind of like a mummy. Would that be about right? That was really not the practice of the Jews. That was more the practice of the Egyptians. But from what I understand concerning the Jews' practice, they would wrap the body loosely, mixing in certain spices and such for the preservation of the body. So it would not be an uncommon thing for the man. How shall I express this? We're talking about a man that's dead, so saying he would have the ability to walk, that sounds a bit strange. But being bound hand and foot doesn't necessarily mean that his body was positioned to be immovable. He could come forth when he had life again, when Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth. I don't see him just floating out of there. But what we see is him being raised from the dead. And like anybody that was alive, he could move. And so the point being, get rid of these bonds. Allow him free liberty. So get rid of the bonds, the wrappings that were customarily placed about somebody who had died. Now, another interesting thing that I find in this passage is remove the stone. Remove the stone. Did Jesus have to be in the presence of Lazarus in order to raise him from the dead? No. Did the stone have to be removed in order for Lazarus to be raised from the dead? Well, no. But the evidence of the decaying body was certainly manifest when the stone was removed. Jesus could heal and had done so from a distance, as we see with the nobleman's son, where he had made him well from about 20 miles away. So being in the personal presence of Lazarus, he could have done that while he was in Bethany beyond the Jordan. Made Lazarus well. He didn't have to be in his presence. But in order that these people around would know who Jesus is, and they would see the glory of God, Jesus was present. He asked that the stone be removed, the evidence revealed, and he said, Lazarus, come forth, and he did. Randy?
A slight aside to complement what you're saying. In John 19, beginning of verse 38, this is following the death of Jesus. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, the secret one, the fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate granted permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Mm-hmm. So 100 pounds of spices, that's a lot.
That sure is. Yes.
That's a lot of spices.
It sure is.
And that's the way they kept the spices close to the body. Was the
right. Right, they wrap it in. Yeah.
So, I'm picturing that that was the way Lazarus was as well.
I would think so. According to their custom, this was the custom of the Jews. Yeah. We'll have occasion to revisit that when we get over to that part, which we're not far from. But we'll have occasion to revisit that in short order. All right. One other thing I want to note on this chart. And that is, what we're reading in John chapter 11 is not comparable to the effects of so-called modern medicine. I don't know sometimes how to respond when somebody's really bad sick and then they get well, perhaps after a lengthy illness, and they get well, and everybody's given up hope. They thought they weren't going to survive, and they say, well, he survived, but it was a miracle. No, it wasn't a miracle. We pray to God that His providence will guide the response of the body to the medications, and the doctors will know the proper procedures. And all of that is in the realm of God's providence. That's not a miracle. And so what we want to know here is we're reading about a miracle. These people understood that. Lazarus didn't get well. There was no mistake about him being dead. You take away the stone, and that was evident. His body was decaying. Yes, Juan?
I mean, I know I kind of touched on it last time when we talked about the blind man being able to see without anything else, and then the man that he commanded to get up and walk, and he got up and walked, and he knew he was like atrophy. There's no way. I mean, even on this, thinking about it, that wrapping your mind about, like, I know what happens to the body when lack of oxygen. I know what happens to the muscles. I know. We all kind of know what that system, and it's, he got up and walked and was fine, like, completely. So everything was back to the way that it should have been. And that, I mean, beyond anything else, there's no way the body could do that.
No.
You know, so it's still really out there, and I honestly can believe, I understand the doubt in them, because this is just unfathomable. You know, yeah, if somebody just died, coming back is the crazy thing, but 4 days is an
Not any way to dispute that. And the interesting thing that I see is the enemies of Jesus did not dispute that. The evidence was clear for them. But lest others see the evidence and believe in who Jesus is, and we lose our prestige, we lose our position, then let's kill Lazarus. Well, it wouldn't be a new experience for Lazarus. He'd already been dead. So there you are with that. All right. Now let's look at the results of this miracle. Let's pick it up at verse 45. In verse 45 it says, "Many therefore of the Jews who came to Mary beheld that which he did, believed on him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done." Again, maybe there's nothing amusing at all about this. But when I read it, I can't help but think of two mindsets. Here you've got one mindset that sees the evidence and is convinced by the evidence. It could not be any other way. Let me ask you, when you read your Bible, and I love to talk about the evidence from prophecy, and you've heard me do this a number of times. Not too long ago, I had a series of lessons on the inspiration of the Scriptures, and we talked about prophecy, the power of prophecy. How could these men know, writing 1,000 years, David did, before Jesus came, the details about his life, about his death? How could Isaiah know what we just read in Isaiah chapter 53, that he would be buried in a rich man's tomb? How can he know such specifics so far ahead? You can't remember something that happened in your immediate family. You don't know about it or haven't studied about it. Something like maybe 200 years ago is beyond our ability. But we're looking back 750, 1,000 years, and they're giving vivid details. How could it be any other way? Now, some of those who came to Mary, they beheld the evidence and they said, well, it can't be any other way. He is who he claimed to be. But then the amusing thing that I find is in verse 46, where some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now, you see an altogether different disposition about their revealing what Jesus has done. You see that in the reaction of the Pharisees. So I call these folks, these are the ones that got to go and tell. We've got to tattle to see how much trouble and turmoil we can cause, because we don't want folks believing this. And we've got to suppress the evidence. Now, isn't that what they're doing? Well, that's their objective exactly. So here are folks who saw what was done, but rather than to be convinced, we're going to run and tell somebody that can do something about it. And we think politics is something new. No, these rulers are in a position, they're afraid we're going to lose our power. And if we lose our power, then what else is there? So rather than to lose our power, we've got to kill this man. Now, is that anything new? We'll assassinate him, we'll kill him, we'll do something, because we don't want Jesus to gain any more popularity. Can't be having that. We've got to stop it. So here you've got some that are so bitter, it doesn't matter what evidence is presented. You remember in John chapter 6 when they said, perform a miracle? You remember what they saw the day before? And now they're saying, show us a sign so that we can believe. Well, could Jesus show them any greater signs than what he had already presented? Would anything change their thinking? No, because you've always got this element that may see the evidence, but we're not going to accept it. No matter what comes to pass, we're not going to accept it. We will not be persuaded. Because, you see, I've got some selfish motive behind it. And I'll not be persuaded. So here are some that not only want to kill Lazarus, but they want to kill Jesus. Now in the next couple of verses, verse 47 and 8, it says, "The chief priests, therefore, and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what do we? For this man doeth many signs. If we let him alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." Now you see what's the driving force. It's politics cut and dried, isn't it? That's all in the world it is. If we don't do something about it, we know he's performed many signs. Notice, if you will, when you come over into the New Testament. Randy, I think you made mention of this. In Acts chapter 3, we find a man that was lame from birth. And he was a beggar. And you remember Peter said, "Silver and gold have I none, but what I have I'll give to you." And he told the man to arise and walk. And he did, immediately. And people that knew had been sitting there begging all his life, they knew who he was. They knew what he is now doing. And Juan, to your point, here's a man who's never taken a step in his life. Would it be possible by normal means for this man to just get up and walk, leap for joy? No, it wouldn't be possible. We know that. Some of us who've had lengthy periods of sickness, we know that it takes a long time and a lot of hard work and therapy to get there when you've been disabled for a period of time. But here's a man that all his life, he'd never taken a step in his life. And their explanation of it was, "For indeed, a great and notable miracle has taken place. And we cannot deny it. But that it spread no further, let us put these men in prison, beat them, and charge them not to speak any more in the name of Jesus." Like that's going to work.
It's like they're saying it's him or us.
Yeah.
Which one's going down?
That's exactly right.
Choose.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that's where this is. You see, Brother King again makes this comment. This latest miracle evidently brought about a new and even greater wave of popularity for Jesus among people, causing many to be of the opinion that he was indeed the chosen one. That is, he's the Christ. He's the prophet that Moses had pointed to. And we can't have people believing that, because if they do, we're going to lose our place. Now note that. If he's not talking about politics, I don't know what he is. The leadership among the Jews will lose our place. Yeah.
There's something I remember from a past class, I believe, that what's the whole thing behind the Romans taking away their nation?
Well, the history of that was Rome would allow an entity to exist like the Jews and allow them to practice their religion, as long as they did it quietly. But if you start trying to promote it to somebody else, if you stir any kind of trouble, then the Romans, their soldiers would step in and suppress that. And so they had governors like Herod in place, kings like Agrippa in place over provinces. And these were the trickle-down of power, the pyramid arrangement, if you please, to enforce Roman rule in these Jewish provinces. So the Jews could get along as long as they did it quietly. But now if somebody surfaces over here and claims to be a king, like Jesus, we see old Herod immediately wants to spy, "Well, where is he to be born? I want to get that done. We'll take care of that while he's an infant." Why? Because, well, we don't want any uprisings. We don't want any struggle in the Roman Empire. So they would let it exist as long as it wasn't anything new or cause a problem. And that's where then we find that not only the Jews begin to persecute the church, but as we get over to Acts chapter 12, they begin to employ the Roman government to do the same thing. And the church then is identified as troublesome. It's a sect. Okay, Randy?
I was just going to mention the Sanhedrin as well. The Sanhedrin Council was what the Romans allowed as the representative council for the Jews. So the Sanhedrin deals directly with the governor. In that case, at the time, Jesus was Pilate. Pilate was the governor, and so the governor dealt with the Sanhedrin. And by the Romans coming and taking away both their place and our nation, what they're saying is they'll dissolve the Sanhedrin and there won't be any representation anymore.
That's right. That's right.
Because the Romans have power to do that easily.
Absolutely. And they would. Yeah.
Council.
Right. And when you come over into the passage we have on the board, Luke 23, that's why Pilate asked the question of Jesus, "Are you a king?" Well, what's the accusation the Jews have made? This man says he's a king. So we've got a conflict between Jesus, King of the Jews, and Rome. Can't be having that. So they don't understand the nature of his kingdom, and that's why Jesus said in John chapter 18, verse 6, "My kingdom is not of this world." He was not a political threat to anybody. That was not the nature of his kingdom. But that's how the Jews perceive it, and that's how the Sanhedrin court perceived it, and that's how they presented it unto Pilate. Okay? Excellent. So some are determined now, as we look over into the 12th chapter of John, get a little bit of a conclusion here, that we've got to stop this, even to the extent if it means putting Lazarus to death. In verse 9 of John 12, it says, "The common people, therefore, of the Jews, learned that he was there, and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests took counsel that they might put Lazarus also to death, because that by reason of him, many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus." Well, we can't be having that. You see the problem. So we're going to kill this man that Jesus raised from the dead. Now note again, rather than to rejoice that Lazarus, who had died, now lives, let's kill him. Lest somebody else believe. And notice, if you will, once again, that nobody denied a notable miracle had been performed, but we can't be accepting such simple evidence of that. So let's kill Lazarus. They're concerned about losing their power. Now that brings me to Caiaphas, and I want to inject this quickly if we have opportunity or time. In verse 49, it says, "But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said unto them, Ye know nothing at all, nor do you take account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. Now this he said, not of himself, but being a high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but that he might also gather together into one the children of God that are scattered abroad. So from that day forth, they took counsel that they might put him to death." Several things in that, and I doubt that we'll have all the time we need to discuss this, but this man named Caiaphas, he was high priest. Of course, that gave him a lot of impact with the Jewish court. And he failed to see how that Jesus could provide healing for the nation. Now, we're not talking about physically. We're talking about providing for them spiritually, forgiveness of sins through him. He can do that. He didn't come to become a king politically. But Caiaphas has made a prophecy, John tells us, that it would be better for one man to die for the nation than for the nation to die. Now, who must die? Jesus. His prophecy is that it's best for Jesus to die than it is for the nation to die. Well, we'll have to talk about that they might be gathered together into one. Just don't have time, do we? Let me go back and insert a new slide right there. Okay. Well, we'll start with that next time. I want to talk with you about this new nation. Of people, one nation, if you please, gathering them together in one place. And we'll talk about that in the next study that we have together. Okay. Thank you for your attention, comments, interest. Thanks for all you do.